Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for the sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire who are supporting our podcast. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any vehicle you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal, and you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, joined as always by John Rawling and Ian Dark, two of the voices of boxing. Guys, we're here today to talk about Iron Mike Tyson. I mean, he's a guy who was massively influential in my following of the sport, so much so that in 2001, I moved to Catskill to train with Kevin Rooney to learn the Tyson way. Ian, I'll kick off with you. When did you first become aware of this chap called Tyson?
I think it was really reading pieces in Boxing News originally about how they had bombarded sports desks in America with tape of him to try and get him out there and get people talking about him. And of course, they were spinning his amazing story about, you know, how he'd mugged people on the streets of New York and grown up and had the customato as his father figure. And then he was blowing people away in less than a minute. Straight away, he didn't need a lot of selling because obviously there was going to be this guy who had this electric presence. I mean, he was revered, he was reviled, he had this menace and mystique about him, really almost from the word go. So we were anxious to tab what was going to go on in his career, I think, from that point.
John, was that a similar thing for you in terms of, you know, obviously what Ian's talking about there is the campaign led by Bill Caton and Jim Jacobs, where they were basically sending out tapes and highlight reels of Tyson's spectacular early knockouts to all and sundry. And I remember, you know, going through the Boxing News archive actually many years ago, and all the stuff from Jim Jacobs and Caton was there, you know, so clearly that Harry Mullen was in their mail drop at the time. Is that what you remember, John?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, I'd stress again, it's in the time way before social media. So you weren't catching up on videos and eyewitness reports more or less as it happens, which we've got used to now. Boxing News and other publications were absolutely vital to get your news of this guy. And yeah, he was very well publicized and shrewdly marketed in those early days, and also brilliantly matched. So he had a succession of sensational early victories. I think, was it 26 of his first 28 came by knockout or technical knockout? And word was coming across that there was this fearsome, exciting new heavyweight coming bursting through at a time when heavyweight boxing, I think, craved a new star. And it very quickly became a question of not just how good he was and what his personal background was, but when he was going to become the world heavyweight champion.
Yeah, I remember Glenn McCrory, of course, who I used to work with on the commentaries, telling us the story of how he'd gone over to spar with Mike. And he said he was as nice as pie. You know, they were putting on, taping their hands and just chatting. How's everything with you, Glenn? He said, you know, he'd be absolutely charming. Talk about old fights and things. Once it started, he was ripping your head off in every session. He said it was a pretty terrifying experience.
I mean, Glenn's got this great story on Boxing Life Stories where he talks about his first day at the Tyson camp, and he'd left all his PE kit, as it were, back in the day, hadn't made the journey with him. So he had to go and get some plimsolls from a local sports gym and showed up in I think a stringer of a vest and plimsolls and the shortest pair of shorts that he could, were imaginable. And that's how he took on Mike Tyson for the first time.
In his Geordie accent, I remember him, he used to describe it as, "Is all your worst nightmares coming at once?"
You talked there just briefly about you know, how much he knew about fighters and how he wanted to talk about fighters. Of course, Bill Caton was the owner of that amazing archive of the old fights, and which he eventually sold on before his death. But he had all the archive of the great fights going back to time immemorial. And because he was a friend and colleague of Customato, Tyson had grown up as a boy, because remember, Customato was his legal guardian. He'd grown up absolutely steeped in knowledge about all these old fighters. So if you wanted to talk to Mike Tyson about, say, for argument's sake, Henry Armstrong, he could give you chapter and verse.
Yeah, even back then there was a wild side, wasn't there, to Mike? Even when he was with Customato and being and trained by Kevin Rooney, there were a lot of things they had to kind of sweep under the carpet, and that weren't getting out there about his menacing, malevolent side. So that was interesting as well. I mean, they managed to do that quite successfully for quite a while.
Yeah, obviously, that was one of the reasons why Teddy Atlas left the camp back in the day. Gents, did you meet between you any of that early crew, whether it was Cuss, Jim Jacobs, Bill Caton, or Steve Lott, any of those guys?
Steve Lott, I had some chat with, and Jim Jacobs, no, certainly Bill Caton had a few chats with him. I mean, they were very gentlemanly. It was a lovely setup, really, I think they had, but of course, later, you know, Cuss died, Jim Jacobs died, and he came under the clutches of Don King, didn't he?
I knew Caton a bit. He was quite a civilized individual, and I have to say, he absolutely despised Don King with a passion, massively so. And eventually, he lost out on the legal battle and the battle for control of his contract. And King sort of wormed his way in, and Caton became history. Which whether that did Tyson damage is an interesting question, one for discussion maybe. But you know, he had this semblance of stability early on, and it wasn't long before everything around him seemingly became absolute car crash.
Well, it was quite Naz-like in that respect, isn't it? And I think we mentioned that in the Naz episode, where he had this sort of romantic relationship with, or nostalgic relationship stroke, you know, we would call it a romantic relationship with Brendan, you know, and so it's a boxing writer's dream. And Tyson had that with his original team of Rooney, Caton, Jacobs, and Cuss, you know. It was, and then when they went their separate ways, like you said, John, really the wheels started to come off.
And of course, he'd come from a very, very difficult background as a kid, and as you said earlier, you know, he was a boy from the streets, literally, and had goodness knows how many arrests during his early years. And when that stability, such as it was, that Customato gave him up there in the Catskills, when that was removed, then there were suddenly a lot of influences coming onto him, which, even though he had the body of a man, psychologically, did he have the brain of a man? And he found it very, very difficult, I think, to cope.
I mean, he really was wild, though. I mean, if you read that book, Undisputed Truth, he was even wilder than we thought. He was part of an organised gang of muggers when he was about 11 on the streets of New York. So, you know, goodness knows how many people they rolled over and hurt and robbed around that time. So that's how he grew up. That was his background.
Yeah,
his mother knew what he was doing, didn't he? I mean, he once went on record saying one of the things which made him saddest, looking back, his mother died when he was in his teens, but one of the things that made him saddest was that she was never proud of what he did. She was never able to see that there was good in him rather than just evil. All she would do is see him turn up in a new pair of trainers or a new shirt and know that it was stolen and that it hadn't been acquired legitimately. And the older, wiser Mike looked back and said he was deeply saddened by that.
Do you remember when he came out of prison and he was fighting Peter McNeely in that comeback fight? And they said to him, you know, quite outrageously, really, or quite outright, did you rape that girl, Mike? And he said, no, I didn't. But I did a lot of other things I should have been in prison for before and didn't go. And, you know, so we know, I think, what a lot of those things were.
Yeah, well, like you said, the Undisputed Truth is incredibly graphic in many ways. And there were lots of things in there that I was really unaware of, having been a Tyson aficionado, really, because, like I said, I'd been to Catskill and around 99, 2000, I'd started writing a book about Tyson, thinking, you know, there was another side to him and I wanted to portray that other side. But around that time was when he was really coming unglued, and every fight there was a controversy seemingly, but I'm sure we'll come to that. Ian, when was your first time actually dealing with him and meeting Mike face to face? Do you recall it?
I don't think we actually covered him and featured him until he'd become heavyweight champion. So I can't remember the exact fact. I mean, I was certainly at the Mike Spinks fight, you know, on the Atlantic City boardwalk, the one that he blew him away in 91 seconds. And, you know, that was not seen as a 50-50 fight, but it was seen as a big realistic test at the time. And, you know, like so many opponents of Mike Tyson, Spinks was beaten before he got in the ring. He was a terrifying proposition, I think, for most of the guys who faced him. They got in there and you could just see it in their eyes that they didn't fancy it one bit. And of course, he just tore into Spinks and blew him apart. And I think it was 91 seconds. You'll know, Tris, the exact,
that's right,
the exact figure. Just astonishing. And being around him, I mean, he wasn't an easy guy to cover. There wasn't great access to him. They kept him pretty well covered up. He never really fancied doing the interviews before the fight. Other people would do all the talking, it seemed to me, at the press conferences. They'd say what they were going to do to him and how they were going to shock the world, and this kind of thing. And they say, the journalists would say, well, what do you think, Mike? And he goes, yeah, I've heard it all before. We'll see what happened Saturday. And that's how it usually was. He just looked very, very bored with all the paraphernalia surrounding the fight, all the set piece press conferences. And usually it was difficult to get an interview. If you got one, that became a bit of a prized possession.
John, how about yourself?
Well, the first time I actually was face to face with him and saw him in the flesh, if you like, was when Frank Bruno fought him the following year in 1989. And the first thing I was sort of aware of or thought when I saw him is what a truly intimidating man he was in those days. You know, to a young and fairly inexperienced reporter and broadcaster, which I was at that time, he was like nothing else I'd ever seen. He was to a journalist, to a broadcaster, to an interviewer, he was a very, very intimidating guy. And yeah, he could look bored at the press conferences, but when you got in the groups afterwards, when you went head to head with him, it just often depended what sort of mood he was in. Sometimes he'd show sides of his character which were beguiling, which were appealing, which were very interesting. Other times, he sort of looked at you as much as to say, you know, you're scum. I've got no time for you, and I wish, in another set of circumstances, I could beat the crap out of you. And as a reporter, journalist, you were very, very aware of that.
Yeah. He had this enormous charisma, though, that almost sort of came off him like heat. When he came over, you might remember to fight up in Manchester,
Julius Francis.
Yeah, that's right. His camp said he'll do one interview with whatever TV channel has got the rights for the fight. Well, that was Sky Sports. So I got this interview with him in the top, you know, suite at the Grosvenor House Hotel. And we set up and we waited for him. And I wondered what it was going to be like, whether he'd even do it. But he came in there, and I always remember there was a picture, there was a Daily Mirror front page standing on the side as he walked in with a picture of Gerry Adams, who was like, you know, IRA connections in a big way. And Mike, the first thing he said was, he looked at the picture, he goes, "This is a great man." And he was almost like testing me. And I thought, I said, oh, well, some people might say, I was just left. I thought, I'm not going to get into an argument about that before we've ever done. But I don't know why, but on that day, he really did open up. I didn't have to do much. I just pointed him in a few directions. And the interview was a remarkable one. In fact, I'd say it was the best interview I ever did in my career. It had nothing to do with me. It was to do with him. He really opened up on that occasion. And I remember him saying, talking about himself in a very intelligent way, and said, you know, I realize I'm a pariah to most people. I remember the phrase he used. He said, I'm just the gum on their shoe. That's all I am. He said, but they don't know me. They don't see me with my family. They just see me as this multi-million dollar product. And you know, it was pretty much revelatory stuff that he was coming out with and remarkable. But I saw another side to him there, and I walked away from thinking this guy's pretty bright, actually.
I remember that, Ian. I remember pariah being the headline in basically all of the newspapers the next day, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, well, he got widely quoted, the interview, because I don't think anybody'd really ever seen him talk for that long about himself and everything. And I remember he kind of tested me out at an early stage, and he goes, a lot of people might say that the best British fighter is Lewis. And he thought, he's going to think it was Lennox Lewis. And I said, do you mean Ted Kidd Lewis, don't you? And he kind of like, I built a little bit of a bridge there, because he, you know, like John said, he knew all the history of boxing back to front.
That's great stuff. Hey, John, so that trip was actually a dream come true for everyone, wasn't it? Well, apart from Big Julius, because Mike was on form, although he didn't do much. He was, you know, that was when he brought, he brought London to a standstill, wasn't it? And he went into the police station and was waving around at everyone. And, you know, I can't remember where it was. Where, it was in Brixton, wasn't it?
He was absolutely mobbed down there. And he was greeted as a hero when he first came over. It was like, you know, he really did get the reaction that you might have anticipated from the most famous man in the world. It was sort of a Muhammad Ali type reaction that Brixton gave him. And then that continued when he went up to Manchester. And, you know, Ian talks about how he opened up and how he relaxed and probably gave something to us, which he'd not given to anybody else previously in his career. Because I think probably for the first time for an awful long time, he felt as though there was that genuine affection for him, and he connected with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And John, let me ask you this. So John, you talked about that sort of stardust and that aura on him. He's not the biggest man. So you're not a small man, John. So did you think, God, this is quite a small guy who can wreak a lot of havoc? Did his aura make him seem bigger?
He certainly seemed bigger, and he might not have been a tall man. I mean, he always claimed to be 5'11", 6 foot. No way he was, because I mean, I'm not 6 foot. I'm not 5'11". I'm about 5'10". And I can tell you that when I stood face to face with him, he was actually slightly shorter than me. I mean, Ian must have towered over him. But yeah, he, despite the fact he wasn't physically a very big man, he had an astonishing aura about him, because you'd seen the knockouts, you'd seen the power, and you'd seen the intimidation.
Yeah, Ian, talking of that intimidation, Ian, that's something I know that you saw firsthand, because Glenn's told me stories about it, and where you've been made to wait in parking lots outside Las Vegas gyms, waiting to go in an interview and not knowing what you're going to get, right?
There's usually nothing, by the way. I mean, I spent many hours outside gyms in Las Vegas waiting just to see if we could get a couple of lines from him. Do you remember he had those couple of guys who used to...
Horn and Holloway
and John Horn. They were despicable people, absolutely hated them, and they wouldn't help you one bit. So they were at the gym, and they had these heavies waiting outside Johnny Tocco's gym in Las Vegas. And we'd wait outside, and I'd say to the security guys, look, can I just sort of go in for a couple of minutes? We just want to grab a couple of words for British TV with Mike once he's finished doing his training. And so the security guys would go, I ain't asking him. You're going to have to wait. You're not coming past me. Wait till he comes out. So we'd sit there, and then Tyson had come out surrounded by people. And I remember going up to him one time and managing to get my microphone somewhere near him, and said, Mike, can we just have a couple of words for British TV about what's gonna happen in the fight? He goes, you say you're from Britain. I said, yeah. He goes, you got a Bentley like me? Do you drive a Bentley like me? I said, no, I said, I can't afford a Bentley. He goes, keep on working and doing the interviews, you'll get a Bentley like me. And said, this was the stuff I got. So I said, could we just do 2 or 3 minutes interview here, Mike? And he goes, I don't know about 3 minutes. I said, you thought I'd asked him to present news at 10. I mean,
he had fights longer than that.
So anyway, that was the kind of stuff we got. You know, he'd give you a couple of little answers. If we got 2 or 3 lines to use as a clip, we were pretty lucky. We absolutely zero help from anybody in the camp. But of course, he was so big that, unlike most fighters, he didn't kind of need the publicity. The tickets were sold.
How about this, though, Ian? Sorry, I mean, yesterday I asked you about Naz and his reverence for older fighters. What about Mike and obviously, therefore, then Glenn and Jim Watt, your partners in crime? Because I've got a feeling, I know there was something with him and Glenn getting on well, although Glenn sort of said in the podcast I did with him that, you know, that Mike wasn't a guarantee by any stretch. But then I'm sure I read somewhere when Mike was over how he picked Jim Watt out of a crowd and wanted to spend some time with Jim.
Yeah, and he knew all about Jim Watt. I mean, as did, you know, Alexis Aguayo when he was alive. You know, there's a huge embrace between them. And that exists, doesn't it? That fusion of spirit between professional fighters. And I think, yeah, Mike Tyson, he had that because of his great knowledge of the history of boxing. He knew what other fighters had done. But if I'm being honest with you, did that open any doors, bringing Glenn along to say, remember me, the guy you used to spar with? No. Didn't work at all.
Oh dear. John, how about you? Did you have any partners in crime with you that he could pick out? Richie, Duke, anyone like that?
Well, I was usually in those days, when if I was doing it for radio, I'd usually have either been with Harry Mullen, one of your predecessors as editor of Boxing News, who Mike would have known there. But I mean, Harry didn't have an awful lot to do with him. You know, he'd just observe and talk to people around the camp, and he'd say, well, press conferences are not for me. He used to pride himself on not going. And also, I used to commentate quite a lot in those days with Colin Hart. And Colin, for The Sun, was also, he realised that Mike was very good copy, but he didn't have a one-to-one relationship with him. And, you know, I mean, I in those days, I was working for BBC Radio, remember, and you were really trading on scraps. So it was a case of talking around what's been said at press conferences and try and get some sense out of Don King's hour-long monologue and see if you can find anything usable out of that, and make some sense out of the few fairly monosyllabic and pretty disinterested statements from Mike. So actually, as an interviewee and somebody to actually get some sort of a connection with from those who you were with, it was very, very difficult, very difficult. And as I said earlier on, sometimes you'd say various things to him and he just looked straight through you. I remember once I said, I think it was probably when he'd come back and he was going to be fighting McNeely, Peter McNeely, in his comeback fight after the incarceration. And I was at a press conference and I said, Mike, do you think you can possibly be the same fighter, the same level of fighter that you were 5 years ago when you were, you know, heavyweight champion of the world? And he said, none of us is the man we were 5 years ago. And he just gave me that sort of dead-eyed stare. And you sort of think, well, yeah, he's probably right. And maybe I won't pursue this one.
There were some funny moments, though, covering him, weren't there? I mean, you mentioned Peter McNeely. Do you remember how their camp walked around handing us out those little badges saying hurricane warning, as if McNeely was going to do anything in the fight? Of course, they threw in the towel at the first opportunity before he could get hurt after about, I don't know, half a minute or something. Didn't last long, did it? It was Vinny Vecchione in McNeely's corner. The other one I remember was, do you remember when he fought Bruce Seldon?
Absolutely.
City Express.
Seldon took a dive, didn't he?
Well, on the Thursday before the fight, they'd obviously briefed Seldon beforehand, you know, the kind of persona he should present at the press conference. So he gets up at the press conference and he's saying, everybody knows I'm going to be shocking the world when I get out here. Everybody's going to be talking about Bruce Seldon, you know, as of, you know, once this fight's over, my name is going to be a global superstar. Everybody knows that. And somebody in the audience shouted out, "You ain't gonna do shit." Seldon looks back and goes, "Hey, don't be like that. They told me to say this stuff."
That's brilliant. That's brilliant.
There's the sales pitch gone.
And John, you mentioned Bruno. Obviously, he fought the Bruno the twice. Once before he went inside and once when he came out. I mean, realistically, I suppose he always had Frank's number, but were you obviously there was that well-known line, and you guys will know if you can, if this was a professional line or not, but when Frank landed that left hook and it was Harry who said, get him, Frank.
Get in there, Frank. Yeah. I mean, Harry afterwards was always mortified about that. He thought he was massively unprofessional by saying that, but you know, people still remember Harry Carpenter for that one, don't they? And the moment when the emotions really came out, because Frank was immensely popular with the British public at that time. People perhaps who weren't there would find it difficult to equate, but in 1989 he was just hugely popular, and he was known for his friendship and his interviews with Harry Carpenter after his fights, and it was all his nice ones and know what I mean and all that sort of stuff. And Harry crossed over, I suppose, the boundary as he saw it of professionalism. But it was a great moment when he rocked him, and he did rock him. You know, he caught him, and just momentarily, Tyson was stunned. I'm not going to say he was on the point of defeat, because he certainly wasn't, but he cracked him and he stunned him. And that was the moment when we thought, goodness me, can this actually happen? But of course it didn't. Tyson regrouped and ultimately won very, very convincingly, and even more convincingly second time.
Ian, have you ever lost yourself in a moment like that before and rooted for someone openly in front of millions?
I've done it doing some football commentary once. Sometimes you just lose yourself. I know, just like John said, Harry Carpenter did beat himself up a bit about doing that, but I don't think he should have done. I thought it was perfectly okay what he did at that moment. Get in there, Frank. Everybody knew about the relationship between the two of them. They were seen as a
double
great
act.
Yeah, so he shouldn't have done. I thought it was fine. It was just that it was a passing moment, wasn't it? It probably lasted about 2 seconds. And I think Frank probably just didn't really believe he had him going, and he didn't follow up in the way he should have done. But who knows? I mean, he was a massive, massive underdog. But that was a huge, huge fight. I remember I was doing the commentary for BBC Radio on that night. He got the biggest audience that Radio 2 have ever got in the middle of the night. That figure probably is still existing today as a record.
I mean, you talked there about Frank and the belief that maybe he had him maybe where he wanted him. That was one thing that Frank lacked in the rematch, wasn't it? The belief. And obviously when he walked out for that rematch, that was when he crossed himself, 30 odd times going out to the ring?
That was when Hugh McElvanney came out and he said he walked to the ring like a cardinal on speed, which was a great, great line, wasn't it? Great line, you know, crossed himself so many times. But yeah, I mean, he got trouble with his eyes, and I think there was the fear factor, and Frank had no belief at all in that second fight, I don't think. And I don't think he'd argue otherwise if you put it to him. I don't think he had any belief that he was going to win that fight. It's a shame, but that's the way it panned out. And another, I did that fight for BBC Radio, and that was another huge audience. I remember it's a sort of stupid o'clock, and I was told afterwards that there's something like 4 million people listening, which is absolutely extraordinary for a radio broadcast.
I mean, that Bruno fight, the rematch, really carried on from where he left off, clinging on for dear life when he won the title against Oliver McCall. He was sort of still clinging on when he started against Mike Tyson.
Beaten before he came out, like so many Tyson opponents, wasn't he, that night? No doubt about it, Frank. But I tell you, one guy who wasn't beaten before he came out, and that was Evander Holyfield. I remember doing a Tyson Holyfield one. It was the bite fight, the bite of the century fight, the rematch. And Holyfield got in the ring singing. Singing to himself, whistling a tune. And I remember saying, you've never seen a Mike Tyson opponent as relaxed as this. And you could see Tyson look across at him and think, this doesn't compute. Hang on, what's going on here? like a street thing. This guy isn't frightened of me. Well, he'd already beaten him once, of course. So, you know, why would he have been? So he over time, he lost that power to intimidate.
It's an interesting discussion point, isn't it, Ian? I mean, it was Evander was supposed to be the next opponent, if you remember, before you tootled off to Japan and watched him get beaten by Buster Douglas. He was lined up as the next opponent. And if Douglas hadn't done him, I personally believe that Evander would have done, because he was, as you say, the one man around, and Douglas was on the night, of course, he was the one man who wasn't afraid. And if you weren't afraid of Tyson, then his biggest sort of win strength had gone.
Let's go back to that Douglas fight, because, I mean, that's an extraordinary story. There were very, very few British media people there. I think about three. So one of them was Colin Hart. So we got the rights to cover it pretty late on. So Colin got hired to be my co-commentator. I'd flown in from the Commonwealth Games in New Zealand to cover it. And I was in the lift in my hotel and Evander Holyfield got in. And I said, oh, hi, Amanda. You're like, you're forced in a conversation, aren't you? You're in the elevator. I said, yeah, well, I'm from the BBC in England. I said, we might want to interview you after the fight. He said, yeah, not going to be a problem. Yeah, yeah. I said, where are you going to be sitting? He said, I don't know. They never gave me, damn, told me anything. I said, well, why don't you come sit with us at ringside? Okay. So in an elevator, we hired Evander Holyfield to be one of the co-commentators. He was sitting beside me and Colin Hart as we covered Buster Douglas against Mike Tyson. So we were able to turn to him, you know, once he had finished, because obviously, you know, his reaction was pretty important. You know, and he chipped in here and there on the commentary as well, as I recall. But that whole Tokyo experience was surreal. It was Sunday lunchtime. The crowd clapped like it was... They were clapping boundaries at Lord's after every round, when what was happening was like a worldwide sensation unraveling before them. It was pretty clear very early in the fight that Douglas was really, really fit, really up for it, and Tyson hadn't prepared properly. And you could see something could go on here. So, you know, what an amazing thing. I mean, if anyone gets a chance, watch an ESPN documentary called 42-1, which was the odds of Douglas for that fight, because that's a brilliant little insight bit, you know, behind that Tokyo occasion. It still is, I think, the biggest sensation I've ever covered in sport.
Ian, tell us that story about when you rang into the BBC news desk after that and sort of suggested that they might like a report, and then just tell us what happened.
So, well, the background was at BBC Radio. So I did the fight for TV, but I was also still doing bits and pieces before you'd taken over properly, John, from me, doing the some reporting for BBC Radio. So I ran the BBC newsroom, because it being Sunday morning in England, and of course I ring this guy with a very posh voice, and I said, oh, hi there, my name's Ian Dark. I said, just been covering the Mike Tyson Buster Douglas fight in Tokyo. I said, it's a bit of a sensation. Tyson's been beaten, you know, it's one of the biggest upsets in the history of the sport. And the guy goes, well, yes, we've got a lot of economic news this morning. He said, oh, I don't know that will actually fit into the bulletin. And I said, I think you'll find it will when you ask around. I said, I'm going to just put me through to somewhere, one of the studios, and I'll leave a piece for you anyway. So I left the piece. So turned out it was the lead story. So this blinking sub-editor who'd answered the phone, he'd end up being the lead story. And I must have had... When I got back to the hotel, I must have had calls from about 40 different outlets in the BBC asking me to come on and talk about this. But it had to be me and Colin Hart, because we were the only people there, really. I think it was maybe somebody from the Mirror. I don't know, but it was regarded as such a formality that nobody went much.
It was like the second Holyfield fight. I was over there covering it for BBC Radio, and they, for whatever reason, they decided they didn't want to do commentary on that. So I was just over there as a reporter. And then what happened, you know, with the piece of ear lying on the ring canvas. And my God, I did so many reports for every possible program, every possible bulletin, including television, under the sun. I don't think I've ever produced as much in a shorter period of time. Everybody wanted to hear. And of course, on that occasion, there was also on the back of that, there was the story of the supposed gunshots ringing out and the riots on the floor of the MGM. The casino was closed and it was just mayhem. It just seemed that these extraordinary stories used to follow Mike Tyson around.
That was terrifying that night at the MGM. I remember that happening. I mean, I'm pretty sure there were gunshots and there was a whole...
They tried to say it was champagne bottles, didn't they?
Well, they were tired of people running for their lives through the casino. I remember hiding behind a roulette table and then waiting for a chance to dash out the door. And we all fled for it. So, yeah, it was...
Ian, I thought you said you were hiding behind a roulette table and waiting to push Glenn out in front of everyone. Hey, let me mention this time. We've mentioned some of the names around Tyson. Do you guys have any good crocodile stories?
No, I've got quite a lot of stories, not too many good ones. I mean, he was the noisy, constant irritant who was hanging around Tyson as his principal cheerleader, wasn't he? He was just that one of the members of the camp who was seemingly incinerating vast amounts of Tyson's money wherever he went. And he was a guy who'd done time for manslaughter and he'd become close to Tyson. And he just used to sort of walk around the casino or wherever he was, bellowing fight time at the top of his voice. The only time I've seen him vaguely intimidated was actually when he fought Bruno. He walked through the MGM Grand Casino near the bar, near the entrance where everybody used to gather and all the British fans were there. And he comes wandering through bellowing fight time and the British fans pretty much chased him through the casino.
Wow, that's great. That's great. Ian, I mean, you would have seen him obviously around the fights, but never really crossed paths with him that much.
I had a few conversations with him. I think we might have interviewed him even a couple of times. He was like a mascot. He was always dressed in kind of army combat gear, wasn't he?
That's right.
It was peculiar, but you kind of took no notice because nearly everything surrounding that whole Tyson story was peculiar, wasn't it? From the word go right to the end of his career.
Well, talking of peculiar, I remember the first Tyson fight I ever went to was when he fought Andrew Gullotta in Detroit. And that was advertised as being carnage between two guys that were, a couple of sandwiches short of a picnic, shall we say. And it kind of delivered on that, really. I mean, Tyson came out and hit Gullotta, who then really basically quit despite the urgings of Al Serto trying to stick his gum shield in back in and send him back out to fight. And then after that Gullotta fight, I think I saw you, Ian, actually out in Denmark for the Brian Nielsen fight.
That's right. And Nielsen came out to keep on looking on the bright side of life.
That's right. Yeah, the Monty Python song. That's right. In a packed park. And there was about 40,000 people there, wasn't there? People climbing on chairs to see Tyson. It was mayhem.
Yeah. I mean, they had that kind of crowd there that we found out the week before for the Eurovision Song Contest as well. But I mean, obviously, it was a huge happening. What I remember about that fight is going to the weigh-in, and Tyson was over 17 stone suddenly. I thought, what? He hasn't trained a day for this. But yeah, he still got the job done. But that again was very weird. I mean, every twist, every turn, there was something going on with Tyson, wasn't there? And
I don't know if you were with us, Ian, when we went for dinner when we were in Copenhagen. We went to a very nice, fairly good standard restaurant. And obviously the entourage, I'm not sure Tyson was there, but the whole entourage had been in there. And one of the waiters, a little bit indiscreetly, told us what their bill had been. And apparently they'd finished off the meal by guzzling the equivalent of a 5,000 quid bottle of vintage brandy. And this, of course, was all being done on the back of what he was earning. And There wasn't just one or two of them. There was a whole crowd of them who were going out and larging it on the back of Mike.
Yeah, he ended up owing Showtime, you know, the American channel who were covering him towards the end of his career. You know, they were there, weren't they, for the Lennox Lewis fight? He borrowed a lot of money off them, and so I think that, you know, the boss of Showtime at the time, Jay Larkin, you know, bless him, bless his soul, nice guy. I mean, he was under pretty strict instructions from above. How's this been allowed to happen that we owe Mike Tyson all this money? So they had to get that Lennox Lewis fight on at the end of his career. That's why he had all those guards in the middle of the ring. It had been the bust up at the press conference. The fight had to happen so that you know, the TV company could get some of the money back. So, you know, the whole story of how what happened to all the money Mike Tyson earned. I remember going to a Nevada State Athletic Commission hearing about him, and they went through what had happened to a $30 million purse, and it had ended up, Tyson had only ended up with about $3 million of it.
Wow. Well, that fight, as you say, it very nearly got pulled, didn't it? Because I remember talking to Jay Larkin about it, and it was vital for their network particularly, although it was also televised by HBO, if you remember, as well. It was a joint production, wasn't it? But it was vital particularly for Showtime for it to go ahead. And it all kicked off at the Hudson Theatre, and Tyson wound up biting Lennox Lewis's leg. Lewis smacked him a couple of times, and I think part of the problem was that Tyson believed he'd been wronged by Lewis, that he'd been chinned. He was the one who wound up getting punished for the bite, which he subsequently apologised for. But he felt that the whole media and boxing in general was railing against him rather than seeing exactly what happened. And if you remember, do you remember the press conference which Lennox called in London afterwards? And there was the heavyweight champion of the world there. We were all called and summoned, and he dropped his trousers on the podium, and he's showing everybody this inch wide wound on his thigh, which apparently he's still scarred by to this day. But you know, I mean, Las Vegas said, right, we don't want it, and that's why it wound up eventually being in Memphis.
But it gave us a chance to go and see Graceland.
Yeah. Presley's home. And BB King's bar.
Yeah. I remember Mike Katz. Do you remember Mike Katz, the grizzled American fight reporter who had very little time for Lennox Lewis? Never gave him that good a write-up. And you remember the fight was at somewhere called the Pyramid Arena in Memphis. So he'd written his piece predicting that, you know, Tyson was going to beat Lennox Lewis in the fight, and the headline, I'll always remember it in the paper, was "Mummy's Boy to Get Buried in Pyramid Tonight." Because they thought Lewis always had his mum with him, didn't he? You know, Violet. So I thought, well, it's a great headline, but you know, it was a lovely headline, but of course, it was totally wrong.
what a one-sided fight that was. Hey, I mean, is that how you obviously Tyson looked like a threat for the first round, but then he absorbed an absolute beating, didn't he?
Oh, it was. I mean, it was really sad to watch, wasn't it? It was almost like watching Larry Holmes against Muhammad Ali back in 1980. Yeah, a one-sided systematic beating with Lewis in total control and Mike just a shell of himself. And at the end, he was sort of groveling and almost, he kind of hugged Lewis, didn't he, at the end of the
fight? Didn't he wipe some of his own blood off Lennox as well, I think, in a sort of a soft gesture as well?
Quite strange, wasn't it?
It's sort of the cyclical nature of boxing, isn't it? Do you remember was it 1988 when Mike fought Larry Holmes, and Holmes was clearly a long way short of the man he once was, and he goes and beats him up, and then, you know, then they have Tyson against Lewis in 2002, and the full circle's almost been done. It might have been a fight in 1990, who knows, but in 2002 it most definitely wasn't.
You know, it was too late, like a lot of fights, wasn't it? But of course, there was a British boxer who beat Mike, wasn't there? Danny Williams in Louisville.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, he was completely the last fight of his career, if we disregard Roy Jones. You know, by then he'd become a parody, hadn't he, of Mike Tyson. He still looked like Mike Tyson, but that was as far as it went.
Yeah, but I tell you what, that night, Showtime, and I mentioned the financial arrangement they had with Tyson. Jay Larkin, the boss, I remember he cornered me at the hotel before the fight with Danny Williams and said, I mean, he said, your guy's, he's not capable of beating Mike, is he? And I said, actually, he is. I said, he gets amazingly nervous, Danny. I said, but he does have a level of ability. I said, he's not a bad fighter. I said, if he turns up and he can get past the psychological barriers here, I said, he could get into the fight and cause him some real problems. And he looked very, very worried indeed when I told him that. He said, are you serious? I said, yeah. I said, he's not just a stiff. I said, he can fight. Well, you saw what happened. For two rounds, Tyson let go, but he was only a two-round fighter by then. And Danny had that amazing win. I remember we got a warning halfway through the second round that the tornado might be approaching the area. He was all cracking off that night as well.
Well, that was I think for that win, obviously credit to Danny Williams, but a lot went to Jim McDonald, didn't it, for his mind training with Danny and giving him the confidence. I don't know if you guys remember that, but Jim was very focused on getting Danny's mind right for that one.
Yeah, and the other thing that happened around that fight was there was a big complaint from the hotel where Tyson was staying because he'd let loads of pigeons loose in his room. And there
was pigeons. As you do.
As you do, yeah.
Well, if you've read The Undisputed Truth, Ian, which you alluded to, then I think they'd rather have the pigeons loose in the room than the issues with the hotel they had in Tokyo. But in terms of going at Memphis, which we touched upon with the Lewis fight, he actually had his next fight in Memphis as well. And Ian, I'm sure you had a big interview with him around that, because that was the Clifford Etienne fight where he showed up a week before with a new tattoo on his face.
Yeah, I don't think I did get a big interview.
No.
The only big interview I ever got with him, Tris, if I'm honest with you, was the one I told you about at the Grosvenor House Hotel. It just didn't work that way. I mean, I got maybe a minute or so with him, you know, with him giving his thoughts on the fight. But as John's described, we were all feeding off scraps with him.
Sure. John, that was a memorable thing, though, when he showed up a week before the Clifford Etienne fight with that new facial tattoo, which he still wears to this day, obviously.
Well, yeah, you're not going to get rid of that in a hurry, are you? With his Maori tattoo. I think everybody sort of looked at him and thought, what is this? And, you know, and there it is to this day. And the Etienne fight, he wound up picking up yet another big fine after that for smacking his bloke, smacking his opponent after the bell had gone, I believe, wasn't it?
I think that might have been that might have been the Orlin Norris one. I think Etienne, he did fold like a deck chair quickly.
Yeah. And there was the one with, was it Franz Botha, where he tried to break his arm?
Botha gave a good account of himself in the early rounds of that fight, I seem to remember. And then of course, it all went crazy. Yeah, they locked arms and he admitted afterwards, he said, yeah, I tried to break his arm.
And of course, one thing we've skipped over entirely here, gents, is the night in Scotland with Lou Savarese, who he bombed out in a wet night in Glasgow in 30-odd seconds, then sparked out John Coyle as well, and then said to Lennox he wanted to eat his heart and his children and whatever else.
Yeah,
He'd had the massive row before the fight with Frank Warren as well, if you remember, because he claimed that he'd been promised some hugely expensive watch on Bond Street as a result of coming over to fight Julius Francis. Thought he was going to come over and pick up this watch worth God knows how much. And Frank said, what watch? You know, I've not bought your watch. And it all went down from there. And, you know, Frank turned up eventually with his eye damaged, supposedly by an altercation with Tyson in a hotel bedroom. And then on the night itself, It was absolutely like the end of the world, wasn't it, Ian? The weather, it was just horrific. You know, you talk about what Glasgow can do. It certainly produced it that night.
Yeah, it was pouring with rain all night. The fight lasted 50, 51 seconds. And as you were saying, Tris, I was standing beside Jim Gray, the American interviewer, when he did that interview, and Tyson said, I'm going to eat his children. And I'm thinking, do I say to him in the interview when I pick up and to do my interview, Lennox actually doesn't have any children? I think I'm probably going to leave that one aside. I was genuinely pretty frightened about what he might do. He was that kind of fired up and steaming. And of course, he still had all the energy for the fight because he only had to fight for under a minute. So, I remember sort of mentally keeping my distance when I did the interview with him after Jim Graham's rather more famous interview.
Yeah, well, Jim Gray had a few bangers with Tyson over the years, didn't he? And he did, I think he had to do the one after the bite fight, which he did, I think was an award-winning interview. Him and Tyson, by the way, are something of a double act now. They've done some podcasts together. I remember Tyson went when Jim Gray was inducted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame, and they're quite pally now, those two, which is interesting to see.
That's interesting because that interview, the award-winning interview, he was really good with Tyson after the ear-biting fight. And I remember Don King trying to muscle in halfway through to put his views and Jim Gray turning around to him and saying, "Shut up, Don," and carrying on with the interview. he was involved in another one. I'm going off subject a bit, but the story is worth telling anyway. Do you remember James Lights Out Tony? You know, it could be a lovely fighter, couldn't he? And we did one of his fights, and Jim Gray got in the ring afterwards, and they'd obviously had a bit of a history together. And so Jim starts the interview and goes, "A lot of people have criticized you over time," and he said, "But tonight you starred," and Tony goes, "Do you know what? I'm already sick of your dumbass questions," and knocked the microphone out of his hand. And that was the end of the interview.
Wow. John, were you ever given short shrift by anyone like that?
being told that they didn't want to talk to me. Yeah, I had one or two. I mean, Nigel Benn gave me one or two anxious moments on occasion. I remember once we'd been meeting, I think at the Dorchester, and he was goodness knows how late turning up for this press conference. And I sort of literally had to run down the street following him to try and get a few words. And he wasn't desperately cooperative. I think it's fair to say he could be a bit feisty in those days, Nigel.
Hey, so we talked a bit about Tyson and obviously the chance of him being a bit hit and miss and him being, you know, feisty is the word John's just used for Ben there. Did either of you see or were privy to Tyson coming unglued away from the public eye and not obviously, you know, circa Savary's fight and different things like that? Were either of you there when he lost the plot at all?
Well, we weren't allowed to be there, were we? And that's the thing. The media and the press were just kept completely away from him, and it was very apparent that he was talking to us under sufferance around fight time, and the rest of the time he simply didn't want to know.
Quite a contrast with Evander Holyfield, who used to hang around in the press room almost waiting to be interviewed ahead of fights. I think that was his way of getting fueled up for a big fight. I was even asked a little bit naively by my Sky Sports editor at the time if I could get an interview with him on the Friday night when they'd already weighed in. He said, "Could you get one last clip of Evander Holyfield?" So I rang his room and a voice answered and said, "Hello, this is Evander's suite." And I said, "Oh," I said, "look, you're probably going to say no to this, but I've been asked by my editor, you know, could I get another interview with Evander, you know, ahead of the fight? And I know he'd be resting up now." And he goes, "This is Evander." I said, "Oh," well, I said, "I wasn't expecting you to answer the phone." He said, "Yeah, we're just going to have some tea. Come around." we ended up having tea with Holyfield's team. What a contrast to Tyson. Like John said, you couldn't really get near him. Of course, most of the things he made, all those sort of unsavory headlines, happened in the middle of the night, really, didn't they? I mean, you remember that there was the street fight with Mitch Green. That was another one, wasn't it? Yeah, many stories, and the sort of the whole thing with the gold digger, Robin Givens, and all that. You know, it was...
And the relationship with Don King. I mean, there were some pretty frightening stories around that, weren't there? There was the car park incident where he supposedly smashed King. And I mean, well, it's down in black and white that he referred to him as a reptilian motherfucker at one time, didn't he? I mean, it was not exactly a promoter-fighter relationship made in heaven, was it?
Well, I was at the International Boxing Hall of Fame a few years ago, and it was the banquet on the Saturday night. And Don King was sat in the big row of guests that they have up on the top table. And Tyson was called up to say a few words. And I was very mindful that they'd been at daggers drawn over the years. And I think they've not long come out of a lawsuit that wrangled on for years. And I was sort of being mindful to watch to see if anything was said, because Mike would have to walk behind King. Mike walked up behind King. Said his piece on the microphone, gave a perfectly fine speech, went back to his seat. And as he went back to the seat, Don King went to stop him to say, thanks for old times or whatever. And Mike picked up a glass of water that was on the table in front of him and tossed it over King. And that's on YouTube now. So we have mentioned that there, by the way, obviously the loss to Danny Williams. After that came the loss to Kevin McBride. And that was that. I mean, We talked about history repeating itself, but what a way for someone to go out, back-to-back losses to Danny Williams and Kevin McBride. When we talk about the skyrocketing Mike Tyson, I seem to remember almost as a kid that when he was invincible, seemingly in 87, 88, that he was going to be the heavyweight champion until about 2000 and beyond. John, did you ever buy into that hype that he could keep on the straight and narrow and be unbeatable for a long period of time?
He was incredibly exciting, and for people, and I don't mean this to sound remotely disparaging, Tris, but for people of your age, he was this hero figure who impressed and captivated your enthusiasm in the way that Cassius Clay, then Muhammad Ali, did for Ian and I. But I don't think, you know, I mean, it invites the question, where does Mike finish? You know, where does he belong in the all-time list? And I don't think he's very high, to be honest. He's clearly below. He's clearly below below Holyfield. He's below Lewis, and I think he'd be below one or two others. Would he have beaten Riddick Bowe? I think that's a very big question. Would he have beaten George Foreman? Would he have beaten Joe Frazier? You know, I mean, if I get up to the other side and I'm writing or broadcasting and campaigning for a fantasy match between former fighters, assuming that Mike pops his clogs at some stage, I think Tyson versus Joe Frazier would have been an absolutely astonishing fight. But is he in the all-time top 10? Maybe not.
Ian, how about for you?
There was a time, wasn't there? I think we've got after everything we've said about this turbulent career, there was a time when he did look invincible. His speed was incredible across the ring, and then the power to go with it. I mean, he was like a force of nature for a while. But, you know, as John says, there wasn't the longevity. And you can always talk about these mythical matchups over time. I think most people have, you know, Muhammad Ali, Joe Lewis, Larry Holmes, like around the top three, don't they, all time? And then you can have your arguments. But it was only that little 2-3 year window, and it became pretty evident not long really after he became the youngest heavyweight champion against Trevor Burbick. It became evident that his life would unravel, and in the end, instead of thriving on the chaos, it would start to impede on his performances in the ring. So it became downhill really from quite an early stage. 1990, not so very long after that peak, you know, the Buster Douglas defeat. And did he ever really get back from that? The career went on, there was the jail term. And so I don't know where you'd put him. Maybe not, maybe towards the bottom of the top 10.
it didn't do him any favours when he split with Kevin Rooney, did he? Because, I mean, the whole ethos of a custom arto fighter was peekaboo, bob and weave, and not only inflict the huge power, which he had with those terrifying hooks and powers from both flanks as well, but it was also being defensively smart and finding a way to bob and weave your way into range. And unfortunately, after Buster Douglas, and Buster Douglas kind of gave the blueprint, didn't he? And he also showed that Tyson, when he gets it, maybe can't really take a shot. After that, he was never quite the same. And I think that it was the defensive smart moves as well as the aggression. I think the aggression probably was always there, but defensively, he became a very much more suspect fighter.
Yeah, he slowed up, didn't he, too much. He just believed that the power would get it done without the trimmings you've described.
Sure. I've had some fantastic experiences with Mike Tyson over the years. One of the last ones was a couple of years ago when BT Sports sent me out to do a sit down with him talking about the first Wilder Tyson Fury fight. And that was the brief. So it was really had to be on message to get what we needed. We had that sit down interview to do, and we had some promotional lines for him to record. And we got there, and I think it's safe to say Mike had been, should we just say, partaking for the sake of any argument. We did the interview and it was fine, and we got some great stuff. Maybe I did 20 minutes with him on that occasion. I have done a couple of other longer pieces with him, but we then got him to do the promo lines, and I'm not sure that there wasn't some sort of mushroom involved concoction in the kitchen. And anyway, we ended up asking him to do these promotional lines, and he had a laughing fit and was in hysterics, and it was all captured by BT, and they did release some of it, and it is just hysteric. If ever I'm feeling down, I might just put that on, because it's when you get that contagious laughter. And it was the best part of 4 minutes where he couldn't get himself together, and everything that he said just prompted. He had the I was going to say the whole room, there was only four or five of us, but in absolute extreme laughter, just because he couldn't get it together. But it was very funny. And you think about the Mike, the intimidator and all the rest of it, and he was an absolute gent. We were out at a friend of his in his house, I think in San Bernardino, and it was just a lovely place, and it was a really good experience. A very, very funny day that was with Mike. And obviously, it must be interesting for you guys to see what's become of Mike, because he was this whirlwind who said he was going to be dead or in jail by the age of 38. And yeah, he might have done a couple of sentences by the time of 38, but he's not inside now.
Well, it's incredible. I mean, you never thought this guy was going to die in his bed. I thought he'd be found dead in the gutter somewhere and wouldn't live to 50. But he's become a bit of a Hollywood star. Must have made some good money out of that, didn't he? And he did that. You remember he did that on stage show for HBO with Spike Lee, wasn't it too? And you've described the things you did with him there as well, Tris. So, you know, he's almost become this kind of semi-lovable figure in later life. So maybe, you know, that there's a happy ending, because I remember a quote he gave to me once, and he said, you know, we write our own horror stories. If they ever put me in Madame Tussauds, it'll be in the Chamber of Horrors. So I think he was a really complicated, and they had a very complex wiring up back in the day. Maybe he's a bit more sorted now. Sounds like it.
Those of us who were around when he was in those troubled years, you know, as Ian and I were, and many others in the British media, and you sort of looking at, as we said earlier, at one awful story after another, it is kind of unexpected and also very nice to be able to look at him now. And some of those long interviews he's done with the likes of Joe Rogan, for instance, you know, he's unrecognizable from the man who terrorized the world of boxing and created headlines of an altogether different sort 20 odd years ago. You know, he has seemingly found some sort of contentment. And I think that for anybody, you watch any troubled figure, to see them come through and find that, I think he's quite gratifying.
You mean he's lost his title as the baddest man on the planet, John?
He's not a bad man anymore. I don't think he'd still be somebody who you would choose to take the piss out of, but he's found some sort of happiness.
He's found some peace, that's for sure. And guys, this has been a great episode. I really enjoyed picking your brains on your memories of Mike Tyson. I really appreciate your time, as always. Very much looking forward to reconvening. Thanks a lot, and I hope everyone enjoys this, and speak to you all soon.